to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection, Oregon State Legislature, in 2007. Today is January 22nd, and we will be having an informational meeting today on the Construction Claims Task Force, which has been looking at a huge issue in consumer protection around construction and buildings. So our first invited testimony will come from the Department of Consumer and Business Services from the Building Codes Division, and Mark Long. If you would wish to come up, that would be good. And along with him, I will have Eric Grassberger, the chair of the Construction Claims Task Force, join him. And Mark, if you could just give us a little bit of background on why this task force and a little bit of history where it's gone and obviously where we're headed.
Sure.
That would be helpful for some of the committee members that may not have been exposed to this last session.
Sure. Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Long. I'm the administrator of the State Building Codes Division. We're a division that's part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. You should have at your in front of you three documents for available to you. I will kind of provide that background and then walk you through the report. You should have a full report from the Construction Claims Task Force. A quick overview that kind of lumps the issues together we use to communicate to a variety of folks. And then we did provide for you a full copy of the insurance study, which is also has an overview within the full report. As far as background goes, last session, House Bill 2078 directed our agency, as well as the Construction Contractors Board, working with the Department of Energy as well, to study the relationship between construction defects, potentially rising costs and insurance, problems that contractors were expressing with availability of insurance, and problems that consumers were having with construction defects. I got to tell you, it's one of the only times that I've been made aware of where the issues of energy, building codes, Construction Contractors Board, and insurance were put into one group to study all those issues and report back to the legislature. That report, as I indicated, is in front of you, and I'd like to walk through and provide just some outline of the report itself, what's included in there, and let you know where we're at today. Quick background, the work of the task force occurred over 18-month period last year and in 05 and in 2006. We had 16 meetings that were conducted by the task force. There were over 80 recommendations, both on insurance and construction defects, that were presented to the task force. We had 30 invited experts come to us and testify through various panels that we put together at the task force. We had 350 individuals signed up to a website. We created a website to communicate the activities of the task force, to receive information, to share information and make it available to the public. We had 350 different folks receive that information on an ongoing basis throughout the course of the task force work. We had over 400 submissions to the website alone, giving us ideas and whatnot that, again, fell into those 80 different recommendations. The task force broke its work down into three phases, where we first studied what you would call construction defects, and we spent quite a bit of time on that. It became abundantly clear to the task force that prevention was important, and so we spent, I believe, 8 or 9 of our meetings on just the defect side. Then we broke into an insurance phase where we had 3, 4, maybe 5, I don't recall specifically, in meetings just on insurance, availability, affordability. We had a study, which again I provided for you, with an outside consultant, and they made 6 recommendations just specific to insurance. Then we spent the latter part of this fall and up until very recently taking all that information and finalizing it into this document that we're presenting to the legislature. Within this document, what I'd like to do, Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, I'm not going to go through every piece of it because it is 97, 98 pages. But I would like to show you how it's laid out and what the task force was attempting to communicate to the legislature and to the public through these issues, and then talk to you about kind of our overview sheet, and then turn it over to Chair Grassberger. If you see in the beginning of the report, it has an executive summary where you can quickly see the specific, from kind of a problem statement standpoint, recommendations that the task force was dealing with. Yes, ma'am. This is it. And there were 11 final groupings of those. Building code requirements, additional enforcement capacity for the Construction Contractors Board, a consumer assistance fund, additional consumer information, enhancing the permitting process for building permits that are obtained either by consumers or contractors, and then competency and training standards for those that work on a building envelope. You can also see the insurance pieces in that executive summary. First-party warranty, liability coverage, streamlining the group liability process, voluntary loss control discounts. We'll talk about those in some detail. Data reporting. We also took the report, and I'm just kind of turning on, I'm on page 3, and we provided complete background as to the activities of the task force in a little more detailed fashion, and took each of those issues I just talked about in the executive summary, and you can see the specific recommendations that occurred within that particular area. As an example, there are 5 specific recommendations to improving the building code under changes to the building code. I believe there are 6 under enhancing the Construction Contractors Board enforcement capacity, and so on throughout the main body of the report. As you look through those issues, they're very specific, and they hopefully provide direction not only to the legislature but to the agencies, because many of these require an administrative fix and some of them require a legislative fix. But we also kept together kind of the discussion papers, and I'm on page 15, where we, for the historical record, laid out the conversation that was occurring as the task force went through those 16 meetings, the testimony from some of the invited experts, the staff analysis of what other states were doing, the recommendations that the task force asked staff to come back with, and then the final action of the task force that carried over into the executive summary and the full report. We think that this provides a historical record of what was discussed, what the task force intended, and will help, again, the legislature and the agencies implement the recommendations accordingly. Also included, and this goes through the phase 1 and phase 2 building code pieces or construction pieces and the insurance pieces. We also provided an overview of the insurance report itself, which is on page 83, called Appendix A. I provided a full copy of the insurance report, but I think the next 3 or 4 pages that are starting on page 83 really provide a good overview about what the consultant looked at and what they recommended the task force and some of the main discussion points. And I'll let Chair Grassberger kind of talk about those as he goes through his piece. We also then included the full list of all the recommendations received by the task force, and we categorized those into, again, the prevention of the defects to begin with and the insurance pieces, and that starts on page 89. So that's about as quick overview without going through the details of the report itself, Mr. Chair. It lays out what our work is. Very quickly, you can see in the executive summary in the first couple pages what the task force is recommending, those 11 pieces. You can see some of the background in greater detail in the body of the report. And if you so choose, you can see some of the analysis, discussion, kind of a living document, if you will, of the work of 16 months with those 30-plus experts, with the 80 recommendations, with all the folks that came to the task force as we went through our work. I've also provided for you, just to kind of break things down into groupings, we thought this document, it's Construction Claims Task Force, and we did label it for the House Consumer Protection Committee for today, But it breaks things down into the issues so that you can see all the different, you can see that we were thinking about how are we going to, in the building code area, prevent defects, what issues impact competency training, and how do we hold folks accountable? Because you need to prevent the issue, you need to provide training and education, and you need to have an enforcement or accountability mechanism, or the recommendation may or may not work. So we broke it up into, here's the building code pieces, here's the pieces that impact permits, here are the things that occur on the construction job site under construction. Here's the enforcement elements. You can see the individual. They tie directly into the individual recommendations of the task force. Here's the insurance pieces. We believe all this leads to greater consumer protection. And there's some specific things directed at, to help the consumers as well, and additional information, the recovery fund, and the insurance pieces as well. So that's kind of just, Mr. Chair, the background of how we came together, what we've done over the last 18-plus months, how we've laid out our work to you in this report, the elements that are covered within the report, so you can quickly see that we attempted to cover a broad range of issues. And one of the things that was very important to the task force that's communicated in our report, that these are a comprehensive list of recommendations, that there isn't one piece necessarily that stands on its own. It all works together. You change a little bit of the building code, but we have continued education requirements for contractors. You require competency and training standards for workers, but then there's an accountability piece with additional enforcement. You can see how all those components kind of go together to get at the issue of preventing defects. And ultimately, it's the view of the task force, and Eric can speak for himself, that these changes will help the insurance market as well. Because as what our consultant told us and the testimony that received, if you begin to reduce the number of defects, you'll see the market shifts change thereafter. So, with that, I'd like to turn it over to Chair Grassberger, but to see if there's any questions about how the report's laid out or the work of the task force or how we got here today.
Well, I think we'll just go ahead and hear from Mr. Grassberger, and sure. Then the committee will digest both your comments and perhaps have a few questions.
Great.
Thank you, Chairman Holvey, and members of this committee. I appreciate your time and interest. I sat where you all are sitting now for many months, and I listened to a lot of testimony. And I know from that experience, it being my first experience on such a committee, that the best way to proceed, for me anyway, was to hear a little bit of background, but then get my questions answered. And so I would invite you at any time to jump forward with your questions, and we can have this be as interactive as you would prefer for it to be. Having been on the committee, as Mr. Long noted, for 18 months, and digesting a lot of testimony.
Just a moment. Can you just restate your name for the record?
Yes, for the record, Eric Grassberger. Was chair of the task force.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Being on the committee for 18 months made me realize a couple of things. One is that having been a construction attorney for 15 years and representing a lot of different members of the construction industry, including consumers, commercial and residential, in that industry, as well as developers and contractors and public agency owners like the City of Portland, TriMet, and certain school districts, that there's a lot to be rectified in our laws in Oregon, not just about construction defects, but in a lot of areas relating to construction claims. The focus of the task force, however, was to investigate construction defects and why they are apparently proliferating in our state, and what, if anything, can be done to help limit construction defects going forward. At the same time, our task force was aware of at least one impetus for our creation, that is the reduction of insurance. And while it would be easy to reduce the cost of insurance by curtailing remedies for consumers, shortening the statute of limitations, making it easier for contractors, designers, and others who, and particularly subcontractors, who commit construction errors to have a shorter period of liability or in other ways less liability, while those things would limit the cost of insurance in all likelihood, those were not viewed to be consistent with our charge, at least not on their own. Our charge, as we understood it, was to investigate why we have defects and how do we prevent defects, and at the same time, what, if anything, is going on in our state that might not be going on in other states that might be leading to higher insurance costs. And that was really the push and pull that our committee started looking at from the beginning. How do we prevent defects and help consumers while at the same time look at what's affecting the industry and making insurance so expensive for the contractors in this state? That is why we had the insurance study done. One of the first things we did was gather testimony from a variety of experts, as Mr. Long noted. And these experts came to us with numerous examples of things gone wrong, and it didn't take long before we realized, from both the testimony from the experts and public testimony that we received from consumers and my own experience as a construction attorney, that there was little question that the defect crisis itself was real. The problems, particularly with water penetration through buildings, and particularly residential buildings, but not only residential buildings, was a real problem, and it wasn't limited to just Oregon and Oregon weather. This is a problem that really has swept the nation. You can go to the driest states like Arizona, and you will see many of the same claims and many of the same resultant problems down there as you see here. But the testimony we received was quite clear that the defect crisis itself was real. And we had a lot of suggestions focused on how do we prevent those problems going forward. We then turned to the insurance study that was commissioned by an outside vendor. And the insurance study, while it had some difficulties because there were problems getting enough information from insurance companies to tell the insurance vendor, the consultant that was retained, what was going on in Oregon, that the net effect of that study was that the average cost for a contractor's annual commercial general liability insurance in the state of Oregon was $1,400 or $1,600, right in that range, a number which seemed low to myself and to, I believe, most of the task force members. We received testimony from certain contractors that were invited to come to our task force meetings that their insurance had doubled, or in some cases I think even tripled, over a five-year period. And I think that that is certainly true in certain cases. The larger contractors building large multifamily apartment complexes, condo complexes in particular, and single-family developments experience significant increases in their insurance. Yet looked at statewide and on average, the number was not alarmingly high, and the number when compared to our neighboring states, I believe, was actually lower than Washington and California. And what I, for one, as a member of the task force, took from that is that while there are certainly cases where contractors had experienced very high increases in their insurance, on average, there wasn't such a sort of cross-the-board sweeping insurance crisis in terms of insurance premium costs that we should focus all of our efforts on just solving that part of the problem. So we were still cognizant of the issue of the insurance premium increases, but we again went back to, well, we know we've got the defect crisis, and we know there have been some complaints on insurance premiums going up, so let's get ideas on how we can make fixes to our system that will maybe accommodate both concerns. And that's how we ended up with the 11 recommendations that we have. There are those recommendations that are clearly aimed at preventing defects in the first place, such as the training that would be required for all those who touch the building envelope. The building envelope is the single greatest source of construction defect claims in our state, and I believe in all states. And everywhere I have practiced law, I see the same errors being committed, from siding defects to window defects to roofing defects. These are all the outside envelope of the structures, commercial and residential. And we decided, the task force decided, that we should go right to the heart of the problem. And we spent, I think, more time on this one item than any other item. And the net effect was a recommendation, I believe it's recommendation 6 under phase 1. And the recommendation boils down to this, that all of those who work on a building envelope, any facet of the building envelope, need to be specially trained and certified to do so. If you're a roofer, you'll receive training suitable for the roofing trade. If you install siding, you'll receive training suitable for that trade. And the hope was that down to the individual worker installing these elements of the building, they will be trained and will be certified. And we heard testimony from union members, members of a union that work in plastering, EIFS, which is a synthetic stucco product, and stucco itself, that they have had a certification and badging system for some time that they were quite proud of and were clear in recommending to our task force that this is a system that's easy to implement and could be, should be implemented to help reduce construction defects through the envelope. In addition to certifying the individual workers, we included a recommendation that each project have a sort of supervisory level inspector whose job it would be to verify at the end of each project that the building envelope was constructed according to appropriate standards and the design documents for the project. These, what we refer to as sort of level one and level two certifications, are again aimed at preventing the defects from occurring in the first place. That, I think, is the single most important recommendation we made. We, of course, made other recommendations, and I can go through each of them if you like. But the recommendations also focused on giving the CCB more enforcement power, more ability to look into the past practices of contractors applying for licenses or renewals of licenses. And so we included in our recommendations the ability to look at past financial malfeasance, past criminal activity that could bear on the ability of a contractor to properly perform its job. We also recommended that criminal citation authority be given to the CCB. A lot of the comments we received from the public centered on some, I guess, disappointment that the CCB wasn't able to prevent some of these contractors from practicing as contractors in our state. And while the task force did not necessarily endorse that there was an endemic problem with the CCB, we agreed that there was always room for improvement, and we asked the CCB, and Craig Smith, I believe, just came into the room, we asked the CCB, where do you think you are lacking in authority and power and in the ability to do your job? And please come back to our task force with recommendations on how you can improve in ways that will help consumers and prevent some of these defects from occurring. And as a result of that invitation, the CCB came back and gave us recommendations, which have been boiled down into, I think, recommendation number one or two under phase one, recommendation number two. We did the same thing with the Building Codes Division. We asked the Building Codes Division what recommendations they would make for improving our building codes and improving the inspection process, the process by which government inspectors for the local jurisdiction where the home or other structure is being built come and inspect the work of the contractor at certain stages for certain things, and how that inspection process can be improved and perhaps made more reliable or at least better understood by consumers. It was clear that some consumers believed that these inspections were sort of the end-all, be-all, final check and almost guarantee that their home or other structure was built properly, when that was not the goal of the Building Codes Division and is, frankly, more than an inspector can handle unless they are to be on the job full-time. And even then, I think it would be a challenge. But we went to the BCD, and we asked them to come back with a set of recommendations on ways to improve the code, and they came back with a few suggestions. And these are provided in recommendation number one under phase one of our report. And the recommendations were to require more clearly horizontal flashing. Flashing is just it's a metal, or sometimes there are other products used to lap over joints or openings in a building envelope that would otherwise allow water to enter the building. And through flashing, any water that comes down the face of the building or down the side of a roof hits this flashing and is diverted away from an opening or a potential opening in a building, preventing the water from entering. Another recommendation was that wood framing members of a structure be tested to not exceed 19% moisture content before the building is enclosed. There was testimony that constructing in Oregon in wet weather and then enclosing that structure with weather-type products was inherently going to lead to mold and other moisture problems in the structure. So that recommendation from the Building Codes Division is found in recommendation number one. We also, in addition to what I've just been talking about, which are sort of, you know, front-end or preventative measures, we also talked about ways to help on the backside when there's already been a problem and a consumer finds that the contractor is unable to remedy the problem. It may be financially unable to remedy the problem. It may be that the contractor's insurance is inadequate, or that the insurance was at some point canceled, or whatever the case. We received testimony that the remedy available to consumers was often insufficient. So we recommended item four, it's item three under phase one, the Limited Consumer Assistance Fund. The goal of this fund is to essentially back up the bond that is required to be a licensed contractor in the state of Oregon. For general contractors, I believe that amount is $20,000. Is that correct? The Limited Consumer Assistance Fund, it was agreed by the task force, should be limited, we think, to $20,000 per claimant with a minimum fund balance of $250,000. Now, this will not take care of 100% of the problems on 100% of the homes, certainly. But the intent of our task force was to take at least a little bit more of the sting away from certain construction projects gone bad. And $20,000 can go a long way for a lot of people, both single-family homeowners and condominium homeowners. This particular recommendation is limited just to residential construction. We also thought that increasing consumer information would be helpful. It was clear from the testimony received, public testimony received, that many consumers of construction services don't really understand the roles of the CCB and the BCD. They don't really understand what's in the contracts that they are sometimes presented with to sign when they want to retain a contractor. And for those reasons, we thought it would be beneficial to increase consumer information and improve the documentation, some of which already has to be given by law to a consumer upon signing a construction contract. One thing that we recommend is that the consumers be required to sign the forms that contractors have to provide to the consumer. This will relieve a lot of what's going on today, and that is a he said, she said battle over whether a form was actually provided to a consumer or not upon construction contracting. Another recommendation we are making is that written contracts between an owner and a contractor are a requirement in order for there to be lien rights on a project. We believe that while not all contracts are necessarily fair or well written, we believe that a written contract is better than no written contract, and we believe that for liens to be enforceable, having a written contract requirement will go a long way towards ensuring that that happens. We also made some recommendations, recommendation number five, has four parts regarding permits. And the thrust of this recommendation was to help ensure that the project has a proper permit taken out, and that as part of that permitting process and the application process, the contractor with its license number be provided, obviously the owner and the address of the project be provided, and that whoever is going to be responsible for the envelope, should envelope work be required, be listed on this application as well. Again, highlighting the need to determine up front who is responsible for the building envelope. And a certificate of occupancy would be required for all residential structures. The phase two recommendations, again, as Mark Long noted, dealt with insurance, although you might not get that from looking at some of the topics of some of these recommendations. Recommendation number one is a first-party warranty. One of the initial recommendations of the vendor that was selected to study insurance was to have Oregon adopt what a few other states have adopted, which is called loosely a third-party warranty program. Under a third-party warranty program, a company, often an insurance company or surety company, provides an overall warranty for a structure covering certain problems within the first year, other problems within the second year, maybe another set of problems within 4 years, and then ultimately, depending on the program, major structural defects will be covered for up to 10 years. And we invited testimony from some of the warranty providers from other states, and we looked at some of the sample programs that they offer in these other states. Ultimately, the task force concluded that this would not be a good fit for Oregon, that there were a number of downsides to these programs, including one that was important to me, which was that the remedy often provided by the warranty was not at least stated in the warranty documents to be nearly enough, in my view, to compensate for the defect. It often did not involve curing the defect in whole, and it often did not involve any compensation or retribution for loss of use or attorney's fees or other costs and damages that a homeowner might realize as a result of a construction defect. We went back and forth on the third-party warranty for some time, and in the end we concluded that a first-party warranty, meaning a warranty directly from the contractor to the consumer, was a better option. And the staff that was appointed to support the task force did research for first-party warranties required by statute in other states. The task force considered what other states had done and ultimately came up with a first-party warranty that we recommend for the state of Oregon. This warranty would be, for the first year, quite broad and cover virtually any construction defect in the home. For the second year, up through the second year, it would cover major systems such as the building envelope, HVAC systems, things of that nature. And then there would be, for a full 10-year period, a warranty against major structural defects. For that piece of it, the 10-year structural warranty, we decided to include an allowance that this type of warranty could be provided by an outside vendor, recognizing that some contractors might be more comfortable with that than a 10-year warranty. For all they know, they might not be in business for 5 years, and I think the committee realized that perhaps a warranty of that duration would be more suitably backed, in some cases, by a third-party vendor, which, again, would likely be a surety or an insurance company. The second recommendation that we made in phase two was to clarify the general liability coverage required of contractors to have a license in Oregon. I don't want to get too technical on these insurance issues, so I'll try to summarize this as best I can. Generally speaking, you can buy insurance as a contractor that covers your work in progress as you're building a structure. That's what I refer to as ongoing operations coverage. You can also purchase what's called completed operations coverage. Completed operations coverage, as its name implies, provides insurance coverage for the contractor for risks and liabilities arising out of projects that are already done. So if a home is built, sold, it's been occupied for 3 years, and then the homeowner has a claim against the contractor for injury or property damage arising out of that structure, and a claim is made against the contractor, the completed operations coverage purchased by that contractor would pick up that claim and provide a defense, assuming it meets the terms of coverage provided under the policy. Current Oregon law does not make clear that in order to have a license, contractors have to have completed operations coverage. Most contractors carry it, but some do not, and it was fairly easy to rectify in the licensing statute to simply add in that completed operations coverage must be purchased as part of the licensing requirement, and the task force thought that was a good idea. Recommendation number three under phase two, the contractor group liability issue, is again quite technical in nature, but to summarize, there are policies referred to as wrap policies. These are insurance policies that are typically purchased for one project at a time. And the goal of these policies is to insure all contractors working on a particular project under one policy. And these policies have been largely provided by what are called surplus line or out-of-state insurance companies. In-state insurance companies, those admitted in the state of Oregon, were not able to sell wrap policies in this state unless the project itself exceeded $90 million in value. That was, we thought, a competitive disadvantage for in-state insurance companies. Wrap policies are growing in popularity. The size of the project that a wrap policy can economically cover has been going down, and we wanted in-state carriers to have the same competitive advantage of out-of-state carriers, and we wanted consumers, many of whom are now commercial consumers, to have the advantage of a more competitive marketplace for wrap policies. And one of the big advantages of wrap policies is that it covers subcontractors who often cannot get insurance for residential projects or residential projects involving certain types of products, such as stucco or synthetic stucco. So a wrap policy essentially fills in the gaps that, if you were to go the traditional insurance route, would otherwise still be there. They are a sort of maturing and growing part of the construction insurance industry, and we wanted, again, to help make the competitive environment a little healthier in Oregon. Recommendation number four under phase two is voluntary loss control discounts. This simply means that the state of Oregon would encourage insurance companies to provide what are called loss control discounts or premium discounts to those contractors that follow the task force recommendations or otherwise follow best practices. And I believe there are more than one sort of informal industry documents in circulation that attempt to summarize what best construction practices are for avoiding construction defects. Recommendation number five under phase two is data reporting requirements. As I mentioned, the vendor that was hired to investigate the insurance issues in Oregon was not pleased with the responses from Oregon insurance companies for certain data. Data on the type of claims being paid out, whether the claims were brought in years 1 or 10, how many of the claims were for this type of defect or that type of defect or for some other type of claim. And because of that frustration, the committee thought and the insurance division for the state of Oregon recommended that there be certain data reporting requirements for insurance companies admitted in the state of Oregon. And this essentially means that the insurance companies will have to keep certain types of data in a certain manner as specified by the insurance division, and upon request by the insurance division, provide that information so that a full and fair study can be conducted and a better understanding of what's going on in our state can be achieved. Finally, Mark, I'm not sure if you mentioned this or not, but we had at page 12 of the report additional issues to consider, and there's a summary that I won't go into in detail here of what those issues are, but they relate to other problems and other potential solutions to those problems that the task force encountered during its work, but either because of time constraints or because of disagreement within the task force as to how important these items are or whether we could come up with a uniform view of how to solve them. We did not include them in formal recommendations, but we included them in what we simply entitled the additional issues to consider portion of the report. That's as good a short summary as I can give. It's really difficult because each of these 11 items has many subparts to it.
Oh, thank you very much for that overview. It was very good, and I'm sure we'll be getting into the specific recommendations when we come to public hearing on these specific recommendations that are in the bills that come forward. And I know there's probably a lot of questions right now, but I would really like our committee to hold the questions right now, and I'd like to bring Craig Smith from the Construction and Contractors Board up to give his overview of the Construction Contractors Board piece of this puzzle, and then perhaps we'll open it up and try to throw a few questions at you.
Thank you, Representative Holby and committee members. My name is Craig Smith. I'm administrator of the Construction Contractors Board, and I apologize for not being in here earlier. This has been an interesting process, I'm sure Mark explained to you. As did Eric, the depth that this task force went into in looking at a variety of issues, it's all designed to try to reduce construction claims. Of course, part of this was fueled by construction contractors' desire to obviously build good structures, but to maintain a handle on what they're paying for liability insurance, which had escalated over the years to a point where some construction contractors were complaining that they're about ready to be run out of business. We maintain that today we haven't lost a lot of contractors, but we still get complaints about liability insurance and its cost. In front of you is the list that we put together that has the CCB legislative agenda, many of which are items that are cross or complementary to some of the task force recommendations. And with your permission, I thought I'd go through those ever so briefly. The first one, Senate Bill 90, would raise the bond from about $15,000 to $2,000. 92 would address minimum contract standards for construction contracts. 97 has to do with the consumer notice and require that contractors maintain a signed copy of that. House Bill 2110 is a similar measure, but would add, if in fact the contractor fails to maintain a copy of that, it would extend the length of time to file a construction contractor's board complaint against that contractor's license. 2107, it would require contractors to notify the CCB if they lost in a court case or arbitration so we could monitor payment of those matters and take the license away from individuals who did not pay those debts. 2108 would require contractors to notify the CCB in the event they filed bankruptcy. We have heard tale of contractors who use bankruptcy over and over again to avoid construction debt. I want to emphasize a couple of things because it sounds a little bit like we're putting contractors under the microscope here, and they should be. But 99% of the construction contractors licensed with CCB pay their bills. They build good structures. They are outstanding members of your community. You know them. It's the 1% that are damaging consumers that we need to do something about. Because when a home, when someone, we're going to be talking with some matters this afternoon, I hope, about a home that an individual says made them sick, made their family sick, and has destroyed their health. And what can we do about that to make sure that that doesn't happen to Oregonians? So, although these sound pretty tough, or some of these do anyway, I want to make sure you understand that most of the contractors are doing great work. One of the things that is tough, however, is the lien law. Lien law is particularly complicated, but today we have a law that allows for a consumer to be put at risk so that they end up having to pay the same bill twice. And we have been dealing with this law for about 25 years now, trying to bring some, I think, some common sense to it. The Construction Contractors Board brings before you today what we brought about 25 years ago, which is a suggestion that if a consumer pays once, that ought to be it. Now, there's another side of that coin, and we'll get into that if your committee so chooses to, and that is that, well, the sub and supplier ought to at least be paid once. And that's true. But why should the consumer be put at risk? And isn't that unfair in today's economy? Senate Bill 91 requires all business entities to notify us if they have new owners so that we can track those owners. Of course, we license businesses. We don't license individuals at the Construction Contractors Board. And from time to time, the owners change. And in some cases, we've had owners that have very, very bad track records, and we take those licenses away. And, of course, this would help us in that regard. 93 would provide a minimum time limit for a revoked license. Today, if we take a license away, the contractor can come back the next day, pay their fees, get their license, and continue operating, and we think that's probably a mistake. 2111 would strengthen CCB responsible managing individual requirements. That's the person that takes the test. Today, that person takes a test, but in some cases isn't actually managing the business. We think that ought to be changed. 2112 would require contractors to notify CCB if they lose their insurance coverage. 2120 would require contractors to maintain signed copy of the information notice to owner about construction liens. And then the remainder of the measures are essentially housekeeping, aren't nearly as interesting, frankly, if I don't go into those. But that's the CCB agenda. And, of course, what's vital is that these measures not interfere with the good work of the task force. And for that reason, we'll be working hand in glove with Mark Long and his efforts to try to bring before you bills that make some sense to try to reduce construction claims. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. And with that, if the committee has any questions they would like to ask of this panel, Mr. Long, you have something to say before we get into questions?
One more thing, Mr. Chair. Just, you know, the insurance pieces, as we indicated, was an important part of the task force work. And we do have Joel Ariel here in the audience, administrator of the insurance division. I know he's got another hearing that he needs to get to, and I didn't know if there's any questions over insurance that you may want to have Joel answer why he can be here.
Still here, right?
Yeah, Mr. Rivera.
Eric did a great job of summarizing, so I'm happy to answer questions.
Right. Perhaps we get some that, if you're sure, I'll bring you up at that point. But I'd like to see if the committee has any general questions over this extremely lengthy and somewhat complex amount of information that's been provided us. But if you do have any questions, feel free to ask them now. We will also be addressing more specifically when the bills come to this committee in public hearing. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question, and I wondered if during your investigations you had determined time periods that were most likely for certain defects to become apparent and be claimed.
Yes, thank you, Representative Riley. We did take a look at that. The vendor that studied the insurance issues obtained some data on that, and I don't remember the specifics of it, although I believe there's a chart or a graph of some kind in their report. And I believe, I'll do my best to summarize according to my memory, that a lot of claims show up early, but a significant portion of claims, particularly water intrusion claims, that tend to make it through the first envelope barrier and into the wall cavity, mm-hmm. tend to nest there for some time, if you will, before they become apparent to the indoor living environment and thus to the observation of the people living or working in that environment. And I believe that there were significant claim percentages of claims found in the first 5, 6, or 7 years. But even in that last 6 to 10 year or 7 to 10 year period, my memory is that 15 or 20% of claims are reported that long out. And in my own experience in these claims, it is often the case that construction defects are not discovered until well after 6 or 7 years, and in some cases after the 10-year statute of repose.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that excellent overview and all of your work. I have a question about the first-party warranty recommendation, and I just wonder if you could answer whether that first-party warranty as set out in your recommendation is similar to other states or unique to Oregon if it's implemented here. Just want to get a sense of what the industry standard is in that area.
I need to flip back to the background data. I believe it was not particularly unique. I do not believe a majority of states have a first-party warranty program. I think that the number of states that had it was something like 15 or 20 states had a first-party warranty requirement. Oregon already has a requirement in that area for condos. There's a condo statute that provides a warranty for condominiums only. It does not address other dwellings or other structures. We did compare what we had drafted here, and in fact, before we drafted this, we had looked at some of what other states did and felt that we were not far away from what most of them were doing. That's, to the best of my memory, that's, I think, where the first-party warranty shakes out in comparison to other states.
Thank you.
While you're on that subject, I have just a follow-up on that specific question. I noticed that in your first-party warranty that you were recommending a 2-year for plumbing, electrical, and something else.
Envelope.
And a only a 1-year on first-party warranty for structural defect. And I know that you have a structural defect that can go up to 10 years by a third party as well, but I'm just kind of curious under that first party warranty why 1 year for the structural and 2 year for those other items in regards to solving our construction claims issues.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at page 10 of our report, item 1A. Under recommendation number one, the first-party warranty states that the residential structure will be free of any defect for 1 year. I may have misspoke, and I apologize for that. I meant to say that the under part 2A of recommendation number one, the residential structure will be free of any structural defect for a period of 10 years. So it is a sort of gradual warranty. Its coverage reduces as you go on in time. But for the first 2 years, there's broad coverage. But after 2 years, the coverage really resorts to only a structural warranty.
Okay, now, that cleared up.
Yeah, and if I may, Mr. Chair, I'd like to explain something else about this warranty. This warranty is not meant to say that after 2 years, there is no remedy for envelope or any other defect. It's just that the warranty itself terminates after 1 or 2 or 10 years. There could be further liability, and there is under the law. Warranties are not exclusive remedies. So this is just a one way of saying that we, the contractor, will warranty and guarantee the following for 1, 2, and 10 years. But if your floor comes along and there's an envelope failure, and there hasn't been some other waiver or loss of the right by the owner can still pursue a claim in the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Chair Holby. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. Could I get an answer as to all these recommendations? How many of them were voted on by the CCTF?
Representative Nelson and Mr. Chair, thank you. That's a very good question as well. They were all voted on. All 11 recommendations were voted on and passed by a majority. And I would note that I don't have the vote counts in front of me, but I believe most of them were unanimous. Now, to get to unanimity, there was quite a bit of back and forth and settling on what you see here as the final recommendations. But these are items that were all passed by a majority and for the most part, by unanimity or close to it.
I might add, Mr. Chair, that each of the sub-items within the recommendations that you see in the report, like item number 2, has 6 components. The task force specifically voted on each one of those sub-items as well. So not only the 11 broad themes, but each individual issue was discussed, debated, and came to a vote to make sure that it was included in the full report.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you, Chair Hobie. Thank you for that answer. If you looked on page 89, if you would, let's see. Let me be sure I've got the right place. I don't. Sorry, page 93. If you look at the regulatory framework, it's my understanding that recommendation E was never presented to this task force for a vote. Would I find record to the contrary?
Representative Nelson and Mr. Chair, I don't specifically recall this being put up for a vote. The item is increased public representation and or oversight on BCD and CCB boards and panels. Let me explain to you, because I think it will help understand why it was not voted on. And again, this is to the best of my memory why it was not voted on. But we had in front of us a very large list, the list that you're looking at here, and we had 9 task force members. And we could debate any of these items all day.
Sure.
And if you look at the makeup of the task force, 4 contractors, 1 designer, 2 insurance representatives, 1 representative from the Department of Energy, and 1 member representing the public, myself, every one of these 11 was debated quite heavily. What we decided to do to try to narrow the issues and to make sure we had a deliverable product to the legislature was take all of these items here in this appendix, and we took stickers, and these were presented on a long board as long as the wall behind you. And each task force member put stickers by the ones it thought most important. And at the end of the day, the ones with the most stickers were the ones that got debated and voted on.
Sure. I appreciate that. Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Nelson.
I've been part of that process many, many times, and when you have so many items, that is a good way to go. However, from a position of us who represent the public in the state, to me, I think that is a very critical issue, and I'm just wondering what you men would recommend that we do to have that issue heard, voted on, included in our procedures. I really believe in public representation on these units.
Representative Nelson and Mr. Chair, I agree. I cannot say as I sit here that I put one of my stickers next to that item because I only had so many stickers.
Sure. No, and I appreciate that. And I can see. Mr. Chair, excuse me, but I'm not expecting you to, be perfect and all this. But I just want to say how important this is. So since we did leave it out, as I understand it today from my constituents, I'm wondering what we could do to correct this.
Well,
anything.
I would be in support of it, first of all.
Okay.
The task force didn't vote on it, and I can't speak on behalf of the rest of my task force members. I think it would require, and I will leave this to Mr. Long and Mr. Smith to perhaps provide further answer, but it would require some form of organic change in the statutes that set up the composition of the CCB and I suppose the makeup of the building codes division. and who sits on the building codes review panel or whatever the technical name of that commission is.
So could we ask for a, Mr. Chair, could we ask for a draft of a way to do this, or what would you recommend?
Well, you're more than capable of drafting an amendment if you so wish to add at some point that can be debated at a further point.
Okay.
But
thank you.
But to follow up, Mr. Grassberg, I just want to ask one thing. You know, in light of Representative Nelson's questions, as the representative from the consumers, was there ever any recommendation that was voted on by this task force that you were the sole one going the opposite direction?
Chair Holvey, the reason I'm hesitating is I'm just trying to remember in answering your question accurately whether there was ever anything voted on technically. I think the answer to that is no. There were items that I pushed that were quite clear to me to not be supported by enough of my fellow task force members that I felt it was a good use of our time to keep pushing it. I will cite bad faith insurance law as one such item. This item in particular, raised by Representative Nelson, was not one of them. But the answer to your question technically is no, but it, not because there weren't items I wanted that I didn't fight for. I mean, I had to look at who was on my task force, how much time we had, and what I thought could realistically be accomplished.
Thank you. I didn't mean to put you on the spot there. I just was
I've thought about that question myself.
I think, Mr. Chair, the additional items that Eric talked about that are on page 12 were some of those, and I think even the one that you mentioned is within that list.
I think the best summary of the ones most near and dear to my heart that I felt I had little support or at least time for are those found in the additional items to consider list. The title of that portion of the report is in some ways a compromise way of getting these before the legislature without a formal vote or formal support by a majority of the task force.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Further questions from the committee?
I just have one.
Representative Smith.
I just was curious. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we solved the insurance problem.
Representative Smith and Mr. Chair, that is not an overnight solution, in my opinion. I have come to be of the opinion that many things factor into the cost of insurance, and in the last several years, the rising cost of insurance, which include disasters, natural disasters, war, stock market, and many other factors. An additional factor is the number of claims, the cost of paying out damages for those claims, and the transactional costs or the legal costs associated with claims. And of the items just mentioned, those within the purview or semi-control of the task force is only the latter item, and that is prevention of claims. And I wish reduction of the cost, the transactional cost of those claims. I believe we made, and if the recommendations are passed, our task force and the legislature would make major strides towards reduction of claims and hopefully, depending on the whole formula that goes into premiums for insurance, reduction in those premiums. I understand, and I'm not an insurance professional, that it takes time for the insurance market to absorb changes in a given market, like Oregon's market, and to react to those changes with lower premiums. So I don't know how else to answer your question.
Great. Thank you.
Other questions from the committee?
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Grassberger, I think you said of the 11 main recommendations, you felt that the number one important one was increased certification for those in the envelope. Is that right?
Yes, Representative Gilliam, that's correct.
So now is that considered a follow-up if I keep going, Mr. Chairman?
Would you like to follow up, Mr.
Reed? Right.
Please do.
I just wondered if you'd say a little bit more about that, because I'm interested to know, in your view, what was lacking? Why is that so important? Do we have no certification? I'm a little new to this area.
Yes. Representative Gilliam and Mr. Chair, this item I consider to be the most important because in my own practice and in the testimony received from the many invited experts to the task force meetings and from meetings with fellow members of the Oregon State Bar Construction Law Section, the overwhelming sentiment is that the majority of construction defects are failures of the building envelope that lead to water intrusion, which rots away framing, sheathing, carpet, drywall, affects electrical systems, can cause mold to grow, which in some cases is alleged to cause sickness, but certainly it causes damage to the buildings themselves. There are other defects. There are defects relating to foundations, such as would be caused by poor civil engineering or soils engineering. There are sometimes structural defects committed in structural engineering or just the construction of structural elements of a building. But by far, if you were to look at the dollars spent and the number of claims asserted arising out of construction defects, the overwhelming majority is water intrusion through the building envelope. So that's sort of part one of my answer. Part two is, then, so what? What do we do about that? Do we simply say that, well, there can no longer be an exclusion in insurance policies that says mold is not covered by our insurance policy? Are there just back-end things to do to make it so that there's money there to pay for these defects when they are committed? Or do we find a way to prevent them from ever occurring in the first place? And we focused, and this item focuses on that. And so the goal is to prevent what I believe often happens in our insurance markets. I'm sorry, in our construction markets. And that is construction projects are under significant time pressure. Everyone wants their job done sooner rather than later. They're incurring interest costs and other costs while they're waiting for their job. They want to move into their house or their condo. There's all kinds of pressure to move quickly. And when the weather is best and when it's time to get going on a structure, if you hire people off the street or wherever you may find them, labor pools, labor supply companies, if they are not trained in the particular envelope trades necessary for a successful envelope performance, you will end up with defects like we see. The types of defects we see are simple things in many cases. Building paper, which layers the inside of a wall after you get through the exterior siding, is supposed to be lapped like roofing shingles are lapped, so that when water hits it and gravity forces it down, it sheds all the way down the system and exits the building system through what's called a weep process or a weeping system. In many cases, we have seen paper lapped in reverse order, so that when water travels down, it gets right under the next layer and directly into the building cavity. We have seen flashing and paper working together, not sequenced properly, causing the same sorts of problems. We have seen caulk joints that are meant to hold sealant and help prevent water from getting in that are far too wide or too narrow to accept a bead of caulk in a manner that will prevent that caulk from pulling off of either side that it's connected to and allowing water in. These are mostly simple defects that with sort of basic training can be avoided. And most of the time, as I sit in depositions listening to what went wrong on a project, I look across the table at fellow attorneys and, in some cases, witnesses and clients, and we're all shaking our heads. How could somebody not know that this was the wrong way to do things? Yet it happens over and over and over again. And so the hope was with this item that a basic level of training on these envelope systems by the worker, him or herself, not just one person in a company who's going to be at the home office writing checks instead of watching construction, but at the worker level, if they are properly trained, and it shouldn't take that much training, then we think we will avoid a lot of these defects. and that if secondarily there's somebody signing off on that work, that it meets the envelope requirements and good practices, we think that will put burden on, you know, management within a company to be very careful that the workers are trained and properly supervised.
And certified.
And certified.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Interestingly enough, I have one more. So I know we focused quite a bit on this competency issue, and we're looking at best building practices, essentially, in installing products. Well, you know, and we've had this, you know, huge rise in, you know, claims due to moisture intrusion, especially in latter years, where years before us, we've gone years without that kind, or maybe we just didn't recognize it at some point. So I'm wondering how the proliferation of new products on the market, and, you know, whether the task force really looked into actually new materials that are being used and new products that are on the market as being a part of the issue that we're seeing here, is in that either the products aren't constructed correctly because they're new and we don't have a workforce that's really dealt with them before, or whether these products are themselves kind of substandard when being constructed in wet weather.
Chair Hovey, I'll take a stab at answering that question. There's certainly one product, EFIS, Exterior Insulation Finish Systems. It's foam that was used to look like stucco, a cement plaster stucco, that has been essentially barred by the Oregon Building Code, at least in a certain application known as a barrier system application. So that speaks about one product that has been viewed to be problematic over and over and over again. And so that one has been addressed even before the task force met, and I think similarly many states have barred the use of barrier system EFIS. With regard to other products, there was testimony and discussion on the task force about the multitude of systems and the, you know, the new products that come out every year, from a hardy plank type product that's relatively new to the construction market to, you know, new window systems and new roofing systems. The permutations and combinations of all these different products and systems was, at least in my estimation, too much to really get our arms around, and we didn't attempt to foreclose a product, and frankly didn't have testimony supporting that a particular product ought to be banned or a particular system ought to be banned from the state of Oregon. So we didn't come away with any such recommendation. For a while, we talked about whether Oregon should require what's called a rain screen system. That's essentially a system where every wall, exterior wall, has an air cavity behind it before you get to the interior wall. And this air cavity would have holes, for lack of a better term, at the top and bottom, and it would allow air circulation and the weeping of water down the interior of the cavity and out the bottom. And through that circulation and weeping, we would prevent a lot of condensation and water entrapment in the building cavity. There was a lot of discussion about whether rain screen should be required by our code, but ultimately the testimony we received and the discussion we had on the task force was that there are too many systems out there, not all of which necessarily accept or require a rain screen principle to be successful. And so ultimately, we decided against requiring that every structure in our state have a rain screen principle applied to it. Otherwise, other than that discussion, there was no discussion of banning other products or systems. Although you are right, there one design challenge on every project is what I call compatibility of products and systems. And with the evolution of new products all the time, if you put this sealant product on that window frame, it may not stick. And that's left up to the design and construction professionals to figure out right now.
Thank you. Any other questions? Parting comments by our panelists?
Well, we appreciate the opportunity to present the report to you, and as the chair knows, just to give the committee a sense, about 4 of the 6 Phase 1 recommendations require some level of legislation to implement, and about 4 of the 5 of the Phase 2's recommendations require some level of legislation to implement. So hopefully we'll get a chance to work with you on those legislative packages.
I'm sure it won't be the last time you're in here talking to us about these issues. This is going to be a great challenge for this legislature to get through this and try to come up with good policy that is good for all of Oregon. And I really want to thank this task force, you, Chair, and all the members who participated in this task force and the people who gave you testimony. This was a really big undertaking, and you've done a lot of work. It's obvious, and it's going to take our committee a little time to digest it and start taking these recommendations in the bills as they come forward and getting into them a little more in depth. But this is truly going to be one of the focuses of this committee, I believe, this session. So thank you so much for all your work, and I hope you stay available for more questions.
Thank you.
So at this time, I would like to open up this committee to public testimony on this particular task force agenda and recommendations, or any views anybody would like to offer us at this point. I don't know if we had a sign-up sheet or not, but if there's anybody in the crowd that wishes to make comments, they're free to come forward. Thank you, and please identify yourself for our records and any organization you might be representing, so we can have kind of a flavor for your background. Thank you.
Sure, Will. Thank you. For the record, Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association. And I'll be brief today. Be happy to answer any questions as well. But I just wanted to start off by saying that this task force was formed last session, as you well know, by House Bill 2078. And 2078 was originally, I believe, a construction contractor board bill. It was one that was not, in the end, being used, and we took advantage of that to put in some language that set up this task force, because our interest was in finding a solution to construction defect issues. We were seeing our liability rates skyrocket. We had a concern about that, and about, frankly, in the end, with some of the exclusions, what we were getting for that insurance product, and in the end, then what the consumer gets. So the idea from our perspective was a couple of things. What's going on with the insurance rates and the protection that we're getting under those rates? And then secondly, how do we find a solution to construction defect issues? Because we looked at that as an opportunity to lower the overall number of claims, and therefore hopefully down the road lower the number of construction defect issues and lower our insurance rates, to be perfectly honest. So what was that going to take? I don't think we were sure. We were open to, aside from the insurance issues and how to get to that in the Phase 2 portion of the task force work, we wanted to take a look at additional education for contractors. Today we don't have continuing ed on the building code, and our industry was and our association very supportive of that, so we wanted to look at more or an initial continuing education for contractors on the building code. We thought that was a very positive step. We're also supportive of the Tier 1 education for the subcontractors as we look at the envelope. And now that we've identified that, I don't think it was a big surprise to any of us, but as we looked at the envelope and decided that's where a lot of the problems are we're having, and that's where a lot of the claims are coming from, that water intrusion into the envelope of the house. So we're certainly supportive of that piece. How do we inspect the houses today? What kind of education do we have for the inspectors? Are they getting the right education? And in turn, is the list of inspections that are a list of things being inspected on the job site, is that the right list? Should we add to those? So I think we were really open going into this, and I really have to thank the work of the task force for putting together what we believe is something we're very supportive of. We certainly have some concerns with a couple of pieces of it, but then out of 100 pages of documentation, that's probably not surprising. I think the only thing I'd like to point out before I open up for questions, and as the chair said, I think this is an issue that will be up before the committee a number of times. So as we get more and more into detail, we're happy to go farther and farther into our concerns and our, I think more than our concerns, our support for a lot of this stuff. But one thing we felt we would like to get a better picture of is the scope. And from what we can tell, we are dealing with a problem in the one and two family side of less than 1% of the houses being built today. So as we look at solutions, I think we need to find solutions that match the problem. While we've seen certainly an increase in the publicity and an increase potentially in the number of claims that have been filed, although I don't have that information to know whether there has been a substantial increase in construction defect claims, it certainly seems that way, and certainly our insurance rates reflect additional claims. But while we look at that, I think we want to find the solution within the building code, within the education of contractors, and within the way we inspect houses that solves that. So with that, I will wrap up and leave it for any questions. Thank you.
Any questions of home builders? Please introduce yourself and state your organization for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. We represent the commercial side of the industry, 1,100 members in Oregon and Southwest Washington that build everything from roads and bridges to schools and hospitals, anything that isn't something that my friends here at the home builders build, single-family residential. So we appreciate the work of the task force. You know, they spent many hours, and we had a couple of our members who are commercial contractors spending those many hours with them working through these issues and looking at them from the commercial side of the industry. Commercial construction, residential construction, though married into the same industry, are really two different sectors. On the commercial side, you're dealing in a business-to-business relationship, and in the residential side, you're dealing with a business-to-consumer relationship. Those two different sectors in a lot of ways are recognized in this report, and the report deals with a lot of recommendations about consumer assistance or helping the consumers and the residential aspect of the industry, because the protections and the kind of construction, the similarity in construction is a lot different than when you're dealing with the commercial side. And we recognize the need for strong consumer protection on the residential side, and I know that there are many recommendations here that are designed to make the construction process a little more user-friendly or consumer-oriented, whatever term is best there, but that we support those on the residential side. Because in a commercial environment, we're dealing with our attorneys and their attorneys and architects and engineers and bonds and a lot different kind of relationship between the buyer of the construction and the contractor, a lot more sophisticated contracts. And so some of the remedies that are put forward in this report would not be appropriate for the commercial industry. And we would ask this committee, as the task force has recommended, look at those two issues differently. During the work of this task force, AGC convened its own internal task force to look at the issues that separate commercial and residential construction, and specifically how can we make the commercial construction industry stronger, better educated, better prepared to build buildings, and better protect both ourselves and our owners as we move forward in these contracts. And so we're bringing a piece of legislation that would raise the bonding requirements, institute experience requirements before you can become a commercial contractor, institute continuing education requirements, which we believe, as the task force recommended, are important. But again, we view these as this kind of a separate and distinct component, different than what the task force has recommended. We're one of those areas that the task force has recommended that concerns us is the Consumer Assistance Fund. Well, we believe that's appropriate on for our consumers, which are business owners. Given the level of protection and bonding and insurance, we don't believe that it's appropriate to allow the commercial industry access to that fund, nor is it appropriate to have the commercial industry paying into that fund. That should it exist in combination with whatever recommendations our friends and home builders make, that fund should be a residential only fund, that it should be paid for by residential contractors and open to residential consumers. And similarly, in building envelopes, Recommendation 6 has caused some concern for AGC members. And not that we don't believe that a great deal of training is necessary to install building envelopes, roofs, windows, siding appropriately. In fact, we do. The difficulty is on the commercial construction side of the industry, you're looking at different building envelope components, procedures, structures that are each architect approaches them differently than the last. So structure to structure, there isn't necessarily a lot of similarity. Each one is approached differently based upon the architect and whoever is doing that. We are concerned that any standardized training that might be mandated as a result of this recommendation wouldn't provide any better protection for our businesses that we, our clients that we serve, because again, each envelope is different, and our manufacturers that we work with have their own standards. Our union partners do a great job in training frontline workers. So again, we ask that this task force look at these issues on an issue-by-issue basis. Does it make sense for the residential side of the industry? Does it make sense for the commercial side of the industry? Knowing the differences between those two industries, we'll be here sharing with you our thoughts as each of these proposals come forward. But I wanted to lay the groundwork with you today that they really are close cousins, but they're cousins. They're not twins. So they share some distinctions. And that's just the nature of the beast. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Answers from the committee? Or how about questions from the committee?
Hey, we don't do answers yet.
So looks like no questions for the two of you. I hope you do stay engaged in this process as we go forward. It's very important to have the industry perspective, and especially when it comes to the consumer paying twice in the lien issue. It's particularly going to be a difficult one, I think, for us to deal with. So I hope you stay engaged in that and give me your thoughts on that as we go forward.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to provide some testimony on the Construction Contractors Claims Task Force?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
My name
is Stephen Cafori. I represent the Oregon Remodelers Association, and we are also involved in watching the task force and making comments. Just a couple of observations. One is, I think you've heard this before, and I agree with most of all of what was said just in the last few minutes by these other representatives in the industry. I think I watched this a lot, and it was fascinating because there were a number of engineers and really technically knowledgeable people come and talk about new products and new techniques, and there's been a lot of examination about why we're having all these problems. It's a new technology in the industry, and mostly in the new construction part of the industry. So there's some of this, of course, that applies to remodeling, and there have been claims in remodeling, but what they were talking about was new construction. And as you just heard, we need to make distinctions sometimes between the commercial and the residential side. We also need to look at where it's appropriate to make distinctions between the new building and the remodeling section. We are strongly in favor of the education. One thing that came, I think, just obvious to every single person who watched that was, as we're getting into a new world of technology, people who used to go out with a hammer and a saw don't do that anymore. It's much more complicated, and the needs for updating the education of the people who are working on people's residences is really important. The other last thing I'd like to say, that Representative Smith asked a question, and I guess the answer to her question was no. Did they do anything really about the insurance? No. And 50% of the reason for having this was we have an insurance crisis in the remodeling and home building construction industry. It's very difficult for our members to get insurance at reasonable prices, and when we do, all these things that are all the problems are excluded. So we don't get the coverage for what we're paying for. The committee took a look at it, at the task force, and essentially said, too tough, we can't do anything about it. And so the problem remains, and we perhaps will come back to you this session with some requests for assistance. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee?
I don't think I'll ask another one.
Thank you. We're still inviting testimony on this subject matter.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. If I could, I'd just sort of take off from where Jessica left off. Manufactured homes are first cousins of residential single-family homes, but there is a substantial difference. The construction standards codes are regulated under federal law. There's also a difference in construction techniques. They're built inside of a factory, generally using kiln-dried lumber that never gets wet. So as you look at, we have our own problems, though. Most of the problems identified here aren't problems that the manufactured housing industry has. So as you look at legislation, I just appreciate if you keep in mind those differences. And that'll conclude my remarks.
Good points.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Miner. I think I saw somebody else that wanted to provide some public testimony. Welcome, and please state your name and association, if you have one, for the record.
Thank you. Chair Holvey, my name is Jim Varco. I am here representing the Consumers of Oregon, also a national nonprofit organization, HAD, Homeowners Against Deficient Dwellings. I first would like to apologize for being a bit nervous. I was didn't know this committee was even meeting until sometime yesterday, so I'm a little bit unprepared. So I'm going to do a little bit of ad-libbing, and I apologize in advance for that. I've got a story that goes back over 10 years, but the gist of it was that my wife and I started off to build a dream home 10 years ago. It was, it was our dream home. It turned into a living nightmare for us. We found ourselves in a very short period of time going from doing everything American, responsible American people are supposed to do, money in the bank, retirement accounts, good credit, everything, to literally being within days of living on the street. We had lost, forced into bankruptcy. We were in the process of losing our home. We had lost all of our vehicles. Credit was gone. Everything. We were being persecuted by just about anybody you could think of, creditors. We found ourselves forced into a lawsuit with our builder and also with Lane County. I'm a resident of Elmira, Oregon. In the end, our builder largely got away with what he did to us. Lane County fought us for 3 years, forced us into bankruptcy, ultimately settled with us for $62,500 for their negligent inspections on our home. There was comment made earlier that there tends to be a reliance on the inspectors. I believe some wording was used that as an end-all. I can tell you as a person, you know, going through the inspection process and dealing with local inspectors, they are the final authority. If an inspector says something's okay, the only thing that's over and above that are the courts. That's it. There's no other appeal. In our case, we had engineering requirements placed on us for our home. One wall of the house was largely windows, and the Lane County Building Department correctly required that wall to be engineered. That engineering was done, made part of the plans. Builders decided to blow it off. It just wasn't necessary. I argued with him about it, and then I finally pinned my hopes on the county building inspector when he came out to do the framing inspection. He took a look at it and says it'll be fine. Passed it. Well, it wasn't fine. We later found out from working with several engineers that our $3,000-plus, now $750,000 home was at risk of collapsing because of that failure to comply with engineering, and then also other construction failures that have been performed in the course of building the home. At one point, I appealed to the Building Codes Division to investigate the Lane County Building Department on their inspections, and they did. They conducted this investigation without any discussion with me at all. And I finally got a report back from them saying that the Lane County Building Department had acted very appropriately in administering the building code in our home. I couldn't believe it. Even the Lane County Building Department has never tried to claim that they had acted appropriately in their inspections of our home. Things went on. I kept trying to pursue it. I kept naively believing that somebody in the state of Oregon would care, what was being done. I mean, my wife and I had worked all of our lives, and we found ourselves destitute over this. Excuse me.
That's okay. Just take a breath. We got a few minutes here.
Okay.
Just relax. And it's interesting to hear this story because, as we've heard before, that this task force was primarily set out about trying to provide or do something about the cost of insurance to contractors. But I do take a little bit of exception to that. That's one of the reasons. But the other reason is of course the consumer that's been in a situation like you, and so it is important for you to finish your story for us.
Well, Paul, let me interject here on that topic. I'm sorry, Chair Holby. I'd like to comment that I believe HB 2078 makes several references to consumer protection, and I think there's like four to five of them or something in there. I raised that point with the Consumer Claims Task Force and was told that their primary function was not consumer protection, it was the reduction of construction claims. Arguably, the two go hand in hand. Still, I was a little troubled by that. To that end, one of my recommendations is that we should have another task force from the consumer's perspective to address these issues. Okay. Anyways, to try to pick up where I left off a few moments ago, I again was still naive enough to believe that people cared. I appealed to legislators, and I had some dismissed me, the concerns, not my problem, go away. Others took a sincere interest in it. Representative Gordon Anderson in particular took a strong interest in it, and he's not even in my district. He just had the misfortune to also have some dealings with the Lane County Building Department, so that when he heard my story, it piqued his interest, and he actually came to my home, crawled around underneath of it, examined and looked at the problems I was talking about, and came away saying, this is horrible, horrible. was done. And I might add that 10 years later, my house still stands there, seriously deficient. And as we sit here, it's going to cost a considerable amount of money to bring it up to the minimum requirements of the building code. And my wife and I are working on that as best we can. We were finally able to save our home from the creditors. I appealed again to the Building Codes Division for an investigation into, you know, what had gone on here, and asked them to come and, you know, look at what had happened to our home. They declined to do so. Representative Anderson arranged a meeting with Mr. Mark Long of the BCD. We had a meeting, and in the end, the Building Codes Division did decide to come and take a look at our home. They did, and they wound up releasing a report that, for the most part, said our house is wonderful. I don't want to get too technical, but there's a bolt that holds the house down to the foundation that has a very, you know, clearly stated minimum depth requirement into the concrete that this bolt has to be embedded to be functional. And the ones that were used in our home are far short of that. And yet the BCD came away and said that they're fine as is. This is just shocked, you know. Independent Oregon State building officials, engineers, they just cannot believe that an organization charged with the protection of the public would condone this type of work, but yet they did. I might add, to add a little bit more credibility to my concerns, at one point I invited, and I should have mentioned this earlier, I'd invited the Lane County building official to come out, and after they had issued a final inspection on our home, I invited the Lane County building official, at that time a gentleman named Roger McGuckin, to come out and meet with myself and my engineer at my home. He came out, met with us, and within 15 minutes revoked the final permit that they had issued on my home. That's a pretty clear indication I had problems.
Well, then, I want to thank you for letting us hear this. You know, we got a short time, and your words have not fallen on deaf ears, I believe, on this committee. So, you know, we are concerned about what happens with this issue and the consumer's notion of what building codes do for them and do not do for them in reality is one of the issues I'm sure that, you know, we need to understand and the public needs to understand it. So I appreciate that, but I wanted just for a few moments to bring up Mark Long from the Building Codes Division and Mr. Grassberger from the Construction Claims Task Force just for a minute to respond to a question of mine. Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Varco.
Thank you, Chair Holdley.
I appreciate sitting back down, and I'll have you identify yourselves again for the record, and trust that I'm not going to ask you any specific questions about this case. But I did want to ask a general question. So before you answer, you can state your name again. But my question is, you know, building codes as such do specific things, and, you know, the public thinks that the building code is there to basically tell them that their house is built exactly according to code. And can you describe to me how that scenario really exists and what we can do about informing the public about what the building code inspection really means?
I think I'll take that one, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mark Long, Administrator of State Building Codes. To your first question, I think the best way to think about the building codes, and remember, building codes first start at the national level, and every state adopts a national model code, and 45 states essentially adopt the same code and then make local amendments as necessary, and Oregon does that as well. The codes are designed to provide what I would call community protection. They focus on fire, spread of fire, they focus on flood, they focus on earthquake, they focus on a variety of things. And one thing to keep in mind, it's The codes are geared at as much to do what your neighbor does to you as what happens to your home, because it's about protecting the community from these catastrophic events. As far as the consumers, I think one of the things that the task force recognized through testimony, and it became abundantly clear, was that folks really don't understand the purpose of the codes, and that is fire life safety. And so the task force recommended, and you can see it on page 9, under the residential permits, it's the fourth bullet, and it says implement a standardized inspection checklist which details an inspecting jurisdiction's minimum scope of responsibilities to communicate to consumers what is and what is not inspected by a municipality. Because on one hand, you might have builder saying a local inspector goes too far. I think we've heard that at times. And you might have, on the other hand, the consumers say they don't go far enough, but there isn't a clear list of what is inspected and what isn't on a statewide basis. So what the task force recommended, and we concur, is that list needs to be made available to the public, to the builders, to everyone through the local jurisdiction so that you can see, all right, I understand that I'm making this up, the levelness of my light fixture is not going to be looked at by the local inspector, or a variety of other things that the inspector is not going to look at. A lot of them around the envelope, as we found out, because of the focus of the local inspectors on life safety, electrical, mechanical, structural, plumbing, those kinds of things. So with that, I hope I answered your question. I think that that recommendation is an important one, and through our public information campaign, you can get that information out about what inspectors do and what they don't do, so consumers and contractors are aware, because I think it's a bit of a mystery right now.
Thank you, Mr. Wong. Do you have anything to add to that, Mr. Grassberger?
Chairman Holvey, I would add one thing. This is Eric Grassberger, chairman of the Construction Claims Task Force. I think that there is a fundamental disconnect between many consumers, not just residential consumers, but even sophisticated commercial consumers of construction services. What the building code is there for, and what inspectors are there for, and what they are not there for. And I would confess that in my first couple of years in this industry as an attorney, it was somewhat surprising to me that the codes and the inspectors don't do more than what they do. I think it's somewhat counterintuitive. When you think of the building codes division and inspectors, you think they're checking to make sure everything's right. But the reality is, and as I've come to understand it, the reality is, I think the building codes division and inspectors can't check everything. They are there to enforce minimum life safety standards. And minimum, I believe, is the term used on the front page of the code. That is not at all to say that the issues that affected Mr. Varco were somehow minimum or de minimis in their nature. I don't believe that to be the case. I wasn't involved in his situation, but I am very familiar with his story, and I'm very sympathetic to it. But the task force and I personally recognize this disconnect between what consumers expect from these inspections in the building code and what they really get. And our goal was, as Mr. Long just pointed out, to make at least it uniformly available, or available to consumers, what a uniform checklist is. So there's no variance anymore. So some amount of certainty will be added back in. But I fear even then, you're going to have people that expect the government, the building codes division, and these inspectors to do more than I think economically, practically, they really can. They just can't be the final, check or the final guarantor of the suitability of a structure. I don't think that that's realistic unless we're going to significantly change government. I wish that weren't the case. I wish there could be a solution like that, but I don't think that's realistic. So that's the only comment I would add.
Thank you very much. And with that, at seeing the time, I don't want to crowd the committee that's trying to get in here next like I did last time. So I'm going to thank
you. Can I just ask one question, please, Chair Shelby?
30 seconds. Representative Nelson.
Thank you. And my 30-second question, I'd like y'all both to give me a written answer, and I don't have to take any more time. What recourse does Mr. Varco have? He's a consumer. That's all I want to know.
Thank you. And with that, I thank you very much for your work on this task force, and thank you very much for your testimony and taking the time to be here. Really important to hear from both of you. And with that, I will adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.